That's 6'7", 87-year-old Randy Weston on piano with Marrakesh Blues, Henry Teshier on bass, Azzedine Niles Weston, and Rebop Kwakuba on percussion. This is Lead Stories. I'm Utrice Lead. It is Monday, February the 17th, and we turn our attention to the case Florida versus Dunn, the Stand Your Ground trial that concluded in Jacksonville, Florida, just Saturday. The day before what would have been Jordan Davis's 19th birthday, and the jury said it could not agree that his killer, Michael Dunn, 47, was guilty of first-degree murder for shooting him after a heated argument in front of a convenience store over loud music coming from an SUV Davis and three others were in. The jury did convict Dunn, however, on three counts of attempted second-degree murder for shooting at the other passengers and shooting into the car. 6 months after George Zimmerman was acquitted of all charges in the February 26, 2012 shooting death of Trayvon Martin, 17, in Sanford, Florida, the Stand Your Ground case, the Stand Your Ground defense, rather, again withstands a first-degree murder charge. Attorney at War, Alton Maddox, in the first of two parts of this discussion, we're going to be talking about the legal issues in this case, including race and the Stand Your Ground defense, the conduct of the trial, and why the jury convicted on charges related to Dunn's shooting of the passengers in Davis's SUV, but not on his murder of Davis. Thank you, Alton, for being with us today.
Thanks for the invitation, Utrice.
Well, this case, of course, brings to your mind, I'm sure, many memories of similar cases in which we see a certain pattern. But let me ask you to start with, what is your view of the outcome of the case?
My view of the outcome is predictable based on an acronym that I use in dealing with white supremacy in the judicial system as well as in the political system. And that acronym is HELP, H-E-L-P. And certainly black people need help. And HELP is based on history, ethics, logic, and philosophy. And I think inevitably in all of these cases, you're going to find that HELP, the acronym, explains the outcome. And particularly, I will address the first count of the indictment, which called for Michael Dunn to be convicted of murder if the evidence showed it. I think the evidence did show it. However, I think that HELP came into play in which not only history but philosophy, ethics, and logic all became prominent. And among them, I think that in the scheme of white supremacy, in the notion of one race believing that it is superior to all other races, there is a code of ethics. And one of the requirements of that code of ethics is that in the case of black people, it is always unethical for a white juror to convict a black defendant, to convict a white person for the murder of a black victim. And so when you go back in time and you study all of these cases, the one thing that is always missing is that there has never been an instance in history in which a white juror has voted for the conviction for the murder of a black person?
Well, let's take a look at that jury. The jury was made up of 4 white males, 1 Latino male, 4 white women, 2 black women, 1 Asian woman, but no black men.
Mm-hmm.
Why do you think that the prosecution, and the prosecution had the ability to insist that the panel should at least have 1 African American on the panel, what is the significance of having no black men on the jury?
The significance in my mind goes back to another issue, and that is the case of Batson versus Kentucky, in which prosecutors use their peremptorily challenges in a discriminatory fashion in order to exclude certain persons from a jury. And I think most prosecutors, right or wrong, just by simply looking at it across the board without any specific examination of a particular person, just automatically believe that they would prefer to have a black female to a black male. And, you know, and that's the same thing across the board. There are certain stereotypes. There are certain issues of gender discrimination where prosecutors, just on the face of it, have certain beliefs about certain sexes and certain races, and you try to use that to their advantage. And I think that in this particular case, both sides have pretty much agreed that the last thing that they needed on this jury was a black male.
And another thing that is interesting about this jury, much like the Zimmerman jury, is that this was a sequestered jury. What issues arise out of sequestration?
Well, I think that for me, and this really is a matter of experience again, I'm opposed to a sequestered jury because when a jury is sequestered, they come under the control of law enforcement officials. And during the time that they are in control of these law enforcement officials, my experience has been that they give signals other than those that have been demonstrated in the courtroom. And, you know, I can give you some examples where we've actually proven that when a jury was sequestered, law enforcement officials began to give the jury a whole new view of the case just by simply pretending to be friends to the prospective jurors. And those prejudicial pieces of evidence really advance the case of the prosecution. And so I've seen several cases in which we've had to, after the jury returned their verdict, had to challenge the verdict based on extrajudicial conduct on the part of law enforcement officials. And that in many of those instances, we actually prove that that extrajudicial conduct did take place. So I think that when jurors go home, they don't have the opportunity to bond with these law enforcement officials who have another contract in mind. And I think that that just simply burdened the jury deliberations.
Well, let's look at the charges. And the charges were first-degree murder. That was one count. Then we had the attempted murder charges with respect to the other 3 people who were in the SUV at the time that Dunn began to shoot. And there's a separate charge of shooting into the vehicle.
Uh-huh.
All right. Let's deal with the most important one, which is the first degree homicide, which did not take. The jury said it was hopelessly deadlocked. What do you think might have influenced that decision, that outcome?
I think that, you know, obviously when the jury got the case, based upon the timetable of jury deliberations and based upon the type of jury notes were asked of the court to explain, I concluded that there already was a ringer in the jury room. Basically, a ringer means somebody who was there to create a whole different scenario than the one that jurors would normally engage in that particular case. And so as a result of that, I don't think that there was ever an intention to bring about a conviction in this case until after Valentine's Day and late on Saturday. And I think that basically what that does is to give the defendant a better argument on appeal. Because, you know, the one thing that you do in any trial is keep one eye on the trial jury, but keep another eye on the appellate court and in the type of issues that you have created that should be subject to appellate review. So in a case like this, you know, you can look at this case and say, well, you know, the case can't be won in a trial court, but we can make some hay in an appellate court. And then, you know, the other thing that you have to deal with in an appellate court is that you have the friends of the court briefs that can come in from organizations like the NRA, National Rifle Association, or maybe the Republican Party, or the Republican Party of Florida, all these other different entities that now have a say-so in how the judge or judges should decide this case. So there are many times when you know that maybe we can't win this case at trial, but on review, there are other entities that will come into play and that can be heard from. And this is why many times, you know, when you're dealing with cases like this and you don't have an organized community or a community that is led by some person other than Judas Goetz, that you really run into a real problem. So I think that, you know, this is round one, but there's another round that we have to fight. And the question will be, how well assembled are we for round two as opposed to the other side?
Do you think that the prosecutor made a credible case for conviction on the first degree murder charge?
No, I don't think so. And the reason why I don't think so is because, you see, it is very rare, obviously, for a defendant to take the witness stand. But when a defendant does take the witness stand, the last thing you want the defendant to do is to testify. And so the way that that can be avoided is by not asking open-ended questions. Open-ended questions mean questions that give the defendant an opportunity to explain. And so what you do on cross-examination of that the defendant is to ask very pointed questions that require a yes or no answer only. And so now you are actually putting words in the defendant's mouth. And so you're actually the one that is testifying as opposed to the defendant. And so under those particular circumstances, you won't get the result that came about in Flood versus Dunn, in which first they were asked open-ended questions. There were questions that were narratives, and there were then questions that called for, as answers, self-serving statements or legal conclusions, both which would be inadmissible in a trial court. But because you have the cross-examination process up that give the defendant some latitude. You have already allowed the defendant to continue to repeat his defense in legal terms to the jury. And so when you heard the defendants talk about, I was in imminent fear of my life, or I was, you know, I was in fear of the life of somebody else, or all of that, these were legal conclusions that normally should never have been a part of this trial process. But because they are part of the record now, the jury considered that testimony as well as anybody else. And so when you allow the defendant to explain away from a murder in the first degree, for example, there's no reason why the jury could have come back and convicted the defendant of that. And even if the jury could have convicted the defendant of that particular charge, now you're also dealing with the question of ethics and white supremacy, the question of whether some juror will go beyond what the prosecution has created as a barrier in order to just simply convict Dunn. And I don't think that was the situation that happened. And then you have the other issue where you know, for example, that Dunn is going to present character evidence, and Dunn is presenting it with the understanding that you're not going to present anything that is prejudicial to his reputation. So if Dunn had been a bully in the neighborhood, as some of at least one of his neighbors has said, or if Dunn had been a racist, as the neighbor has said, then Dunn would have never allowed himself to present reputation evidence, because in that particular situation, Dunn is aware that you could come back around as a prosecutor and ask for gossip. Because, see, that's what reputation evidence is gossip. And so you ask a witness, have you heard that Mr. Dunn was a bully? Have you heard that he was a racist? Have you heard these other things that we know as gossip? And that then began to give the jury a totally different perspective on Mr. Dunn and what he may be likely to do in a situation like the one that he faced at that service station.
But couldn't it be argued that, in fact, his testimony was, in fact, helpful to get him off of the first-degree murder charge, in that he explained it and he had an opportunity to emotionally connect with the jury and explain that this fear, this huge fear that he had after he asked somebody in the car to turn the music down, and then reports that he saw Davis reach down in the rear passenger seat and pick up an object that he thought was a shotgun, and this was when he was in absolute fear of his life. He would not have been able to communicate this without himself testifying, and the fact that he did testify was a good thing in that it allowed the jury to connect with him.
Well, and you're absolutely correct, and that's what really I was trying to convey to your audience here, is the fact that by him testifying and testifying the way that he did, that an argument could be made that he was in fear of his life, and that could have been prevented by the prosecution using traditional measures of cross-examination in order to keep a defendant strapped in his witness chair.
Did the judge do harm, or was he helpful with respect to his instructions to the jury on first degree murder charge?
Well, that is, you know, something that I think that really should be given some additional examination to, because I tend to think that most lawyers try the case in the wrong order. And they try the case in the order that the trial presents itself, so that they start off with jury selection, then they go to opening statements, then they go to examination of witnesses, and then they go to summations, and then they go to jury instructions. I tend to think that you really need to start the case off with jury instructions, because this is where most cases are reversed. And even the prosecutor admitted that in a post-trial interview that, you know, when you start getting to jury instructions, judges will look at those instructions and say, wait a minute, now we can see why, you know, a jury was unable to convict on first-degree murder and was able to convict on others because there was too much confusion in the instructions. And so, and we can see why the jury stayed for 3 or 4 days as opposed to delivering a verdict after the lunch break because of the confusion in these instructions. So now you have a basis for the appellate court to reverse. And so if you have actually studied appellate decisions, then you will see that this, you know, and that's why there are so many aspects to trying a case, and one of them is to deal with the reasoning process of the appellate judges and to try to fit your case within that reasoning process.
Still comes a matter that by his own testimony and by the other testimony that contradicted what Dunn had said. Dunn said he saw Davis reach down in the back seat to and produce, in effect, a gun, and that he even saw it being pointed out of the window of the car. And so that was when he went into action and fired off 10 rounds, 9 of them hitting the car, and, of course, Davis killing Davis. The question, though, is that when he testified that way, didn't the jury have enough information to make a decision with respect to one critical aspect of the first-degree charge, which is premeditation?
Well, the problem that you have there is that the jury is entitled to decide the credibility of witnesses. And so even though you may have evidence of a fact occurring, but the jury is also in the court of last resort in the sense of determining whether the witness is actually credible or not. And so, you know, what you have here is Mr. Dunn, so to speak, engaged in his understanding of the law, and him being well coached, and therefore him presenting a script to the jury. Now, whether the jury want to believe that is a credible script or not is another situation. The other thing that you have to really consider here, you know, because I listen to testimony very well. Now, most defenders do not have a real understanding of the philosophy of law. And this wasn't the case with Michael Dunn, however. Michael Dunn had a clear understanding of the philosophy of the law, and he understood natural law as being a necessary part of American jurisprudence. And what he did was to actually testify that self-preservation is the first law of nature. And so when you heard some of his comments on direct examination, he was fitting his testimony within the law of self-preservation in a way that a lot of witnesses would not have been able to do because they would never have been able to understand the philosophy of law. And so what you have here is somebody who may look differently to an appellate court than he did to a trial court.
But Dunn, even though this was his testimony, the jury certainly had heard that there was no gun. No gun was found. So that his testimony that he saw Davis reach down and produce this gun and then pointed it out of the window at him, and this is what made him literally go into a desperate self-survival mode, the jury had contradiction from other testimony that said there was no gun. Police found no gun at the scene. And then after the shooting, Dunn goes to a hotel with his fiance, calmly has pizza. They have dinner. He walked his dog, and he even had a nice rum and coke to make himself relax. And he never did call 911 to report that this major event had occurred. So one would think that a juror, reasonable juror, would say, even though he gave very emotional testimony while he was on the stand, the facts also were there to show that much of what he said just simply was not supported.
And that is true. However, what Dunn decided to do was to put that issue into evidence nonetheless as to whether there was a gun or not in that particular vehicle. And of course, I mean, the argument can certainly be made that the jury rejected that. But the question becomes, what else could Don have done other than to just maintain his story as he did? The second point, you know, that you raise here is flight as consciousness of guilt. And so clearly Don did flee the crime scene. Of course, you know, his story, however, was that he had a date with destiny, so to speak, and that this is why he continued on his way. Now, of course, to all of us who have common sense, this also seems to be questionable. But nonetheless, it is an issue. Now, the third point that you make, that is one of duty to retreat, by, among other things, calling the police. And the interesting thing that Dunn presents here is that his position is that I had no duty to retreat because I stood my ground, and by standing your ground, therefore I am innocent. Now, when you look at the title of the legislation, it does simply say stand your ground. And the question becomes, what does that really mean in terms of standing your ground? If you listen to Dunn, what Dunn really is saying is that I am going back to the original intent of the Constitution, and that's the only intent that I think that the court should be concerned about. And therefore, as a white man who goes into a service station and find four black boys who refuse to assimilate and instead decide to play in a loud fashion coon music, what was I supposed to do? And so, you know, now you deal with another issue here from a appellate level, and I'm not trying to justify any of this. I'm just trying to give people an opportunity to start thinking about how the legal system works. And that is, in this particular circumstance, what is really meant by stand your ground. And if this had been 1857, for example, when Dred Scott was decided, would Dunn have been convicted of what the action that he took in this particular regard? So, you know, this is why I say you have to deal with history, you have to deal with ethics, you have to deal with logic, and you have to deal with philosophy in trying to deal with some of these decisions. And unfortunately, I think all of us will have to admit that the way that the judicial system has treated this issue has not been even and it certainly in many instances, in most instances, have been unfair.
I want to ask about this issue of self-defense again and the judge's instruction on what self-defense is. And the jury asked, if in determining self-defense, whether, you know, we could basically throw that into the mix, the explanation that we got of self-defense, is it to be separate for each person, or should Dunn's action simply apply to all four? And the judge said, no, you have to find that Dunn acted in self-defense in each and every single instance with respect to the four occupants of the vehicle. Is that correct?
Well, this is what is happening here. Florida wants to have it both ways. One, it wants everybody to believe that people have a right to self-defense, and that, you know, otherwise, you know, your life is not necessarily threatened. But on the other hand, Florida turns around and announced a piece of legislation, Understand Your Ground. And that sends a whole different kind of signal to a person who go out and buys a weapon, because now the question becomes, when do my racist instincts become a part of my decision-making process, and whether I really now believe I should stand my ground or not. And so this is really what this case is so important, and this is why blacks now have to fight on two different fronts. One, they have to fight on judicial front, where they present some real committed and daring and lawyers who are willing to take this case up to the Florida Supreme Court and maybe even to the U.S. Supreme Court, as we did in Brown versus Education. Or the other thing is that we're going to have to go back to the legislature and duke it out in the legislative process. But one way or the other, this has become a test case for the license to kill, because there's no such thing as self-defense when, on the other hand, you have the license to kill or the right to stand your ground. So you can't have it both ways. Something got to give here, and this is why this case could get very wicked on appeal.
The state attorney who was a special prosecutor in the Zimmerman case, this is Angela Corey, is the same person who shows up again in this case, and the same person again attached to the Marissa Alexander case, which is also a Stand Your Ground case. Do you think that the prosecution in framing the case did a credible job of, in fact, presenting to the jury the element of race and racism in this case, or was it because of the makeup of the jury, with a predominantly white jury, that they felt that that was not necessary?
You know, Eutrice, I'm getting ready to say something now, and I'm not trying to in any way brush my own teeth or anything of that nature, but obviously, by 1986, we had a real serious problem in New York of racially motivated murders. And we also saw consistently that the shooters or the perpetrators were automatically being acquitted of these particular crimes, and that the judicial system had no problem of permitting this kind of conduct. Now, basically what I did in 1986 was I had to decide how long after 1986 was I going to be able to practice law and to make a living for myself, and whether I should simply ignore what was obviously a practicing pattern at by this time of endangering black lives, or on the other side, recognize that the first flaw in the prosecutorial system is the inability of normal prosecutors duly elected prosecutors to prosecute these matters in a fair fashion. And I concluded that there was an irreconcilable conflict here that could never be resolved in the faith of black defendants because, A, most of the voters in a particular county were black, and even if the voters in that particular county were not black, that on the other hand, you had influential interests that was controlling the way that prosecutions were carried out. And among those were law enforcement agencies. And so, you know, the key thing I recognized then, it's going to always bear it out because I'm actually the only attorney ever in the history of the United States and, you know, to understand this particular issue and who actually put my foot down, at least as far as New York was concerned, to bring it to an end. And as you know, in 1987, we got conviction in Howell Beach. And then in 1989, we got conviction in Bensonhurst. And so black people since then have not had to deal with the racially motivated incidents. In the meantime, of course, the New York legislature said that my own legal career should come to an end. But the greater good is that black people could go into Howard Beach now or into Bensonhurst now or in other neighborhoods that they could not go in now without fearing for their life. So my point is Angela Curry was never a special prosecutor, even in the George Zimmerman case, because she was an elected official and she had an irreconcilable conflict of interest that could not be resolved, and that this has carried over to Florida versus Dunn now, and any other case that she might be engaged in. And until we understand that the first stage in the prosecutorial process is the appointment of a special prosecutor, we're not going anywhere at any time in our own lifetime.
Well, I want to ask you to recast this case and the approach of the case from, you know, a methodical way. How would you, because this is an issue of race, it's inescapable, how would you have presented this case and how would you have proceeded with this case?
Well, the way that I would have presented this case is by any means necessary, and that's what you is attached to the prosecution of a first degree murder case is where in those particular instances it is obvious to everybody all gloves have been taken off and this is a bare knuckle fight and whoever is standing will win, but the advantages are in the in the prosecution, therefore, you know, it should be an expectation that there will not only be a real prosecution in the first degree, but there will also be a death penalty attached to the case. And so when you decide that you're going to indict somebody for first degree murder, but you on the other hand, you turn around and says, well, you know, we don't think we were looking for the death penalty. Well, then you've already signaled to the jury that you're not for real. Because why would you indict somebody for first-degree murder and don't put them to death? So, you know, right now the jury got to realize right now you already backing up. The question becomes how far will you go in the reverse?
This is really a very, very, although, you know, the charge is going to be tried again, according to the special prosecutor, Corey, that she will attempt to re-prosecute Dunn on the first degree murder charge. What chance do you think that has of sticking?
Well, my view is that when you get a hung jury, you've gotten certain benefits that you didn't have the first time around. One is you know the prosecution's case. So you know that, you know, whatever they testified to the first time around, you can bet your bottom dollar that the script is not going to change. And so, therefore, you're in a better position to win a case on the second time around than you had on the first time around. So, you know, I felt like if I can just hang the jury up the first time around, when we go back into court the second time around, I should be victorious.
When the announcement was made that the jury convicted on the other charges with respect to the other occupants of the car on the second-degree attempted murder charge, as opposed to the first-degree murder charge for the actual shooting death of Jordan Davis, it seemed incomprehensible that the same jury could be listening to this testimony and yet be very, very clear with respect to the lesser charges, but have doubts and have issues and questions with respect to the major reason that this case has been called, that there is a case. The case is to decide whether Dunn not only injured or attempted to murder the other three, but in fact did kill at least one. And we have this dichotomy. So from an outsider's point of view, this looks to me like a very odd thing. And I can't put my hand on what might have accounted for it, or what is the game plan here. Was it the judge? Was it the fact that the prosecution was a bit lacking? Was it the fact that the testimony by Dunn himself had been so powerfully persuasive to the jury that they could not see anything but this man fighting for his life, even though testimony contradicted there was no gun and so forth, and that he, after this killing, he took it nice and easy, went, had pizza with his girlfriend, walked the dog, and didn't call 911 to tell them anything. What are we looking at here when we see these two completely different outcomes in the same case, with the same venue, the same trial, the same panel of witnesses?
Well, it's two answers. I'm answering it in two steps. One is I'm gonna say this because, you know, it's gonna tie in to what I'm gonna eventually say later. But first, you should be the appellate lawyer for Dunn on appeal because you have raised the key appellate questions. And that's why I say that this case has another life after the jury verdict. And so the answer to your first aspect as to who were really responsible for all of this is all of the above, because all of them contributed to the state of affair. Now, the second point that you raise is one of inconsistent verdicts. And that is a real lie. Why in the appellate process, whether the jury actually came to inconsistent verdicts, and how is it that they could have, on one hand, said that Dunn was guilty, on the other hand, not say that he was guilty on the murder, which was actually the top count, and which obviously now it gives the appellate judges latitude to try to determine what really went wrong in this particular case, because that has to really be answered. And so, you know, this is what Dunn is banking on now, is that there not really be a real explanation of this confusion. And now he's going to be backed up by all of the well-organized white supremacist groups that's going to help him open the door to his jail cell, while at the same time there's no body on the black side who has come forward, will come forward, to assist our situation. And that's the reason why when you live in a society where you have no representation at all, you are absolutely in direct peril of your own existence. And I don't think black folks understand that. You know, we operate, just like roaches. And as long as, the spray don't hit us, you know, it's all right. But as long as somebody's out there with some spray, we're all in trouble.
Well, it is important to monitor this case and to analyze this case because, in fact, Stand Your Ground is legal not only in the state of Florida but in 24 other states that have similar statutes. So this is not just a Florida case at all. This is this has wide impact.
Well, you're absolutely right. It's not only a Florida case, but let's understand it's actually more than 24 jurisdictions. I mean, I'm not arguing with your numbers. And these are only the states that have just confessed to having Stand Your Grounds. But there are many other states who operate with Stand Your Grounds without saying it is Stand Your Ground. And so when you add those states to that, it's a whole different equation. New York, for example, has a Stand Your Ground law in the way that judges interpret the self-defense statutes. And these judges in this state interpret it in such a manner that any time that a black person kills a white person and claims self-defense, it has to be struck down because it is illegal for a black person to kill a white person in the first place. So I think that when you look at, you know, the numbers, it's a real serious problem. And I would say that it really probably is a problem for all 50 states and not just for 24 states.
What should the African-American legal community be doing about now with this decision coming down Saturday?
Well, unless the African-American legal community has changed since I was practicing law, there is no African-American legal community.
I heard myself asking the question, and then I wondered why.
It was too late. And that's on the real side, because I never had any support ever in things that I was doing. I was doing things in spite of the African-American legal community, not because of the African-American legal community. And from my point of view and where I stand now and given my own personal plight, in which on the most simplest of issues, and that is whether a lawyer can be barred from the courtroom based on a bill of attainder, and I don't get any help at all in trying to advance argument otherwise, then I think we can clearly say that we out here on a pond without a paddle or on a creek without a paddle.
Well, Alton, thank you so much for this this insight today. And I know you will continue tomorrow when we talk about the history of Stand Your Ground laws, which we will discover is deeply rooted in slave codes, in Jim Crow law, in racial re-entrenchment, and in other ways, literally has been on the books, has just been disguised in some places, and it's been overtly stated in others, but it nets the same result, which is why we have to pay attention to this case. Thank you so much for being with us today, and
I look forward to
tomorrow.
I want to thank you for the invitation. I also want to pick the brains of our audience and say that we should all be very thankful for you for presenting this, because this would never be heard on MSNBC. It would never be heard on CNN, and it would never be heard on Sirius Satellite Radio.
Well, thank you so much. I get it. Thank you so much.
All right.
See you tomorrow for your presentation. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Well, that brings us to the end of our program today. Stay tuned. Coming up next is Wake Up Call with Richard Martin. You can reach me at leadstories@gmail.com or on Facebook, Lead Stories with Eutrice Lead. Thank you, and we'll see you tomorrow.